Well, who do we have here?
Carla Tuesday, WDUR, the Durr. Reverend Richard, is it true that you'll be representing yourself?
Carla, let me tell you a little story. I was walking on the beach with the Lord, and there were two sets of footprints in the sand. And then there were three sets of footprints, and I said, "Who's that?" And the Lord said, "It's Dale Earnhardt. He's a big fan of yours." My client won't be answering any more of your questions. Stay in school, kids.
TBTL.
At first he's silly, and then he's magical and quite wonderful, and you just don't know how to react, except you're entranced.
So we're going to play a little game called Cursed or Not Cursed.
You sound like you might be a little bit jealous, babe. No, and I know a little something about being jealous, because people have been jealous of me my entire life.
Well, just so you know, I support feminism. Mostly by having body image issues.
I have no idea what you just said, but I feel totally transformed.
In a few hours, you're going to be smarter than anyone you've ever met.
That story checks out, because this show is probably about an hour long. So then you'd have about 2 hours to get really smart. And that would still technically be a few hours from now, so... just wanted you to know how the rest of your afternoon might play out. Hi, everybody. Welcome to a Wednesday afternoon edition of TBTL, show that just might be too beautiful to live.
Got to do it again right now.
My name is Luke Burbank. I'm your host.
Oh, hey, y'all said my name.
Coming to you from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, perched atop Alabama Hill. It is nice to be back, everybody. It's gone the last couple of days. Andrew and a cavalcade of guest co-hosts were handling things, and handling things very well, I have to say. More on that coming up. But the scene here at Burbank Springs, well, of course, we've got the pod dog.
He was a little dog named Snuggles.
And also the Bay Kitty.
There is something about the soul of a cat.
And we've had some decent weather of late, and my wife has been out doing all kinds of... gardening projects and things
That's
like that.
My wife.
And it's just about the cutest thing you've ever seen, because wherever we are working out in the yard, the animals will come and hang out with us. Really, what the sort of daisy chain on this whole thing, and that's an unfortunate metaphor, is, or is it an idiom? Or am I just an idiot? I'm not sure. Anyway, the way it works is Rudy wants to be wherever we are. And Olive wants to be wherever Rudy is, and we want to be wherever Olive is. So you can see how it just does kind of a circle. I don't know if you're familiar with the shape of a circle, but it's just sort of that thing going on here at Burbank Springs. Other thing that's going on, episode 2387 in a collector series.
Let the fun begin.
You remember the sort of subtle beauty of a computer screensaver in the 90s?
Oh, Ma, Pa, it's just beautiful.
Whether it was those, like, series of kind of, I'll call them pipes that would build up and then reduce down and build up and reduce down, or even some flying toasters or what have you. We're going to talk about the disappearance of those screensavers and why we loved them so much when they were around. Also, the pharmacies and the hospitals of America are full of all kinds of bizarre and complex compounds.
Holy smokes. A little too much magnesium, I guess.
But one thing they don't have, apparently, is baking soda. They don't got baking soda. In fact, there is a baking soda shortage in the hospitals of America that is actually quite dangerous. There are some not just dazzling deets, but frightening deets that we will lay on you when we get to that story. Plus, we've got emails of emails. And a member of the TBTL community has... achieved heights that are almost unimaginable of fame, of being mentioned on the Colbert Show on Friday night. We'll get into that as well. First, though, we have to say hello to this young man who's been handling things during my absence. He is, as you know, the Hodor of podcasting. He bought a balloon, but it doesn't mean he thinks he's better than anyone else. He's known for his drawings of tall ships, and he is the one and only member of the Walsh Ensemble, which I don't even know how the math on that adds up. He's, of course, a soulful rocker from New Hampshire.
Kicking him off, the soulful rocker from New Hampshire.
He's Andrew Walsh, and he joins us now. Hello, my dude.
Baking soda. I got baking soda.
That joke just came into my mind when I was saying those words.
I saw your headline. A spoiler. I haven't read that story, so I'm looking forward to you telling us all about it. I love story time.
Yes.
Some people call it TVTL. For me, it's just story time where I get to hear Luke tell me interesting stories from the news. I hadn't thought of the connection between possibly one of the top three hip hop tracks of all time and this here hospital story.
Yeah.
Hi, kids. Welcome to the magical world of stories.
Right on time with the audio drops. I didn't even miss a day. It would have been better if I could have laid that right on the tail of you saying story time. But the problem is
impossible standards.
We have so many.
I can't
many,
do that at all on the fly.
We have so many things that say story for some reason.
This is the story of cooks.
we have this one, of course.
This story is a beautiful story. From my point of view, it's a beautiful story.
We have some.
And the Golden Globe goes to
Toy Story 3!
Well, I don't know why we used that.
What?
A lot of. Toy Story 3. So many things that involve.
What's your story? Talk to me.
Sorry.
It's implicit that you would play that shot.
It's implicit.
Can I just quickly here at the top of the show, I want to tell you, Andrew Walsh, that I did not yet get a chance to listen to Monday's show with you and our friend Nick Jarin, which I will. But I probably on my drive down to Seattle later today. But on my little jog today, I listened to you and P. Fletch and Steve Scherer on yesterday's episode of TBTL. And it was, I'm not trying to be hyperbolic when I say, I think it was one of the best episodes of the show ever. I shit you not.
Well, obviously, those two are national treasures. Steve's story, if people have not, I believe there is a contingent of people who probably skip the show when they hear my voice first. I could be wrong about that. I don't care. I'm honestly, that's fine. But if you are one of those people, I would at least listen to the main part of yesterday's show, the middle section where Steve talks about this bike accident he was in. It is terrifying. You heard the whole thing, right?
Yeah, it's terrifying, but it's also it's so much more than just a scary thing happened. He's talking about the kind of humanity that people show to other people in those situations, or at least do sometimes. It was a really powerful, really riveting story. But even the first third of the show when you guys were taking the turtle quiz, which was great. I really thought to myself, God, I would listen to this show. And also, God, maybe, and I'm not fishing for a compliment here, but I was like, maybe I should just slowly back away from the program because these three have something. It's just the right amount of every kind of personality. I thought the top of the show was really kind of well thought out, well planned. There was something actually happening there, the quiz, which was, I was totally fascinated by. And also, this is probably an experience some listeners have, I'm jogging along and I'm actually LOLing at some of the stuff you guys are saying. And it's cutting into my, I'm working
Your
my way up.
Your breathing rhythm?
Yeah. I'm working my way up a hill in Whatcom Falls Park. And somebody says something really funny. And then I'm cracking up, and it's actually making it harder for me to run. And I'm both enjoying the product and also, mildly annoyed at you for making me laugh, for making me have feelings. No, but seriously, dude, it was such a good episode of the show. I really think everybody should listen to it if they missed it. And it was just great. You did a really good job, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. The funny thing is, I was actually, this is me not being able to take a compliment, but I do think there's a lesson in here because I was 1,000 times more prepared for Monday's show or going into it. I knew the beats and rhythms of Monday's show much more, right? It was a little bit more typical couple of top stories. Nick is wonderful. Nick comes in here. I don't have to worry about a thing. I know that he's the most yes Andy kind of guy in the world. And yesterday's show, by comparison, probably the least prepared, at least as far as kind of some technical stuff and just kind of knowing what to expect in the show. Yesterday was by far the least prepared TBTL I'd kind of ever done. Yet
what?
I went back and listened to them, and not judging any of the folks that were on with me, because Nick is also wonderful, I was so much better on the show. Just me personally, me post-morting my own performance, I was so much better on the one that I was not prepared for. I was just like, I was slower. As a matter of fact, I wanted to ask you something. We need to have a new rule. Every time I say like, I want to hear one of those. Every time I say sorta, I want to hear one of those. And there's one, there's a trifecta. When I get going and I start talking too quickly, everything becomes like I'm sorta, you know, like sorta, you know, like sorta, you know. And that would sound something like this. Because okay. I need to slow my S down. And yesterday, maybe because I didn't know what was going to come next, everything was a little bit slower and the pacing was better. Maybe it was being in the presence of true radio personalities like Steve and Phyllis. So I don't know.
I would imagine that there's probably a certain kind of relief in having two people in there because you know that there's going to be plenty of conversation, and then having two people who are radio pros and are, you know, great. That's sort of probably takes a little bit of the pressure off. I haven't noticed you to have that issue, by the way, Andrew, of saying sort of like, you know, a bunch, but I'm into the idea of kind of playing some sort of like audio punishment for you when you do that.
Okay.
So I'm thinking I might play this.
Sir, the doctor's appointment to examine the discoloration on your butthole flaps was
too loud, Cynthia. Too loud and too specific.
Too specific.
Even the dazzling donor cracked me up yesterday. I was just, it was a dang delight the whole way through.
Thanks. Thanks for those guys for coming on too. I mean, that was wonderful that both Steve and Phyllis could just like pop over here to Wallingford in the middle of the day. So thanks,
now let's mention a star turn for one of TBTL's, definitely most diligent listeners. Paula Poundstone was on Colbert's show. I almost called it the Colbert Rapport in my intro because that's still in my brain. But of course, this is the late show. This is the show David Letterman used to do, the number one show in its time slot, the now juggernaut that is the late show with Stephen Colbert. And Paula Poundstone was on there and talking about her time on Wait, Don't Tell Me. And get a listen to this.
We have a research department, and they said it says 201 times. That's over 200.
Right. Do you know, I do know, there's a lovely man named Lin Pham who keeps the stats. He's just a guy. He's not hired by the show. He's a guy on Twitter, and he keeps the stats. And I believe I'm correct in saying that I hold the record for losses on Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Okay. You're the least informed.
No, here's the thing.
Panelist
the others,
on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
It would be a great job if the others didn't cheat, but they do cheat. Roxanne Roberts usually wins. But
Lin Pham, or Pham, if you're Paula Poundstone, is officially the most famous, or you could say famous, TBTL listener in history. No. Here's a guy, Andrew, who is probably happy to be the TBTL Dazzling Donor of the Day last week, right up until the point that Paula Poundstone was literally name-checking him on Stephen Colbert's show. WTF. That is what
the fam.
He was
also
on
WTF?
Yeah.
What the fam. Sorry, I stepped on your joke. That's the one thing that you made me promise when you gave me this gig. Don't step on my jokes.
Lynn, congratulations. That's like, I mean, that's insane. I can't believe that happened. That is so cool.
I know. I have not seen, I could be wrong about this, but I don't know that people are celebrating this as much as they should be on the Stens page. Like, I only heard about this through you, and I think one person might have sent me an email about it. But I mean, clearly Lynn knows about this, right? Like,
yes,
we're
he knows about it because
this news.
Yeah, he knows about it because he actually sent me an email. I found out about it through my wife, who was, who is on Facebook. Or where did you see that Lynn got name checked by Paula Poundstone on Facebook? So she sent it to me. I was in. I don't know where I was. I was somewhere. Oh, I was in Seattle because I was going to do this gig on Sunday. And I immediately sent it to you. I was like, dude, can you believe this happened? Then I got an email from Lynn yesterday. He mentioned that he said Paula has brought this up before in smaller audiences. He's talking about what she said later on, which is talking about cheating. He said, but what do you think about her saying that other panelists such as Roxanne Roberts cheat on the show? It was brought up on her interview on Late Night with Stephen Colbert. So definitely Lynn knows about this. It'd be crazy if he didn't. But
right.
to address that question, because, yeah, Paula kind of went on to say that, like, and she's, you know, sort of tongue in cheek. Let's see. Lynn said, I know you've had some misgivings with how certain points weren't given to you or skipped over, but, quote, cheating is something different. So what are my thoughts on that? Well, you know, it's kind of funny because for being like, wait, don't tell me, for being a game that does not have any importance in the world, like the winning of the game, when you don't win for a long time, at least if you're me, it starts to kind of move up in terms of importance. And then you start to notice these little things. Like the last time I was on, they don't ask everyone the same amount of questions, right? And so they were about to ask me a question, but clearly the interview with Guy Ritchie went too long or something. So then Segal was like, okay, next question, Luke. And then someone starts talking in his ear, and then he pauses and he says, okay, coming up, it's Lightning, fill in the whatever. So I kind of got like, I didn't get to answer another question. And you can only get as many points as there are questions that are posed to you. So I remember my head being like, well, now I'm really screwed. Plus, I was on that particular episode with somebody who is always getting grief from Peter, and I think rightfully so, for writing their made-up story not interestingly enough so that it is usually picked by the caller. Because it's like you would never mistake a Mo Rocca bluff the listener question for answer for being real if he is given the task of writing a pretend one. I believe recently he wrote one about how some indigenous people in like the Amazon were using Hormel meat products as aphrodisiacs. That's the level of spoof that he comes up with. And some of the other people who are more competitive, I think that they're intentionally not making their fake stories outrageous enough because it raises the chances that they might actually get the point. Then there are also people who keep notes on stage, like of all the stories, and then they check them off. Now, for the regular part of the show, I don't think that's a big deal because they give you a million hints. Nobody ever doesn't get one of the regular questions right because they're easy and they give you hints that tell you the answer. Now, the Lightning fill in the blank is a little different. You know, it can be... what are you laughing at?
All of this?
I'm answering Lynn's question.
No, I know. I'm sorry. I just, but you care. You do care, Lucas. You care.
I probably do care. Listen, I do care I definitely think that this is slightly weird that, there are a couple of contestants who shall remain nameless. Who I've been there, who like bring all the answers on stage with them. That's what Paul is referencing. It's not that they're and nobody at any point says, "Hey, we're in essence taking a test, and you are in essence bringing all of the potential answers to the test on stage with you." Now, here's
just
the thing: nobody
in form of. Can you explain that a little bit more? So, in other words, they've just done their own research. Let's say it's I don't know, just name somebody.
It's not Bobcat Goldthwait. How about that?
Okay, it's not Bobcat, but let's say it was Bobcat. Yes. So in other words, he's just been doing his research in his hotel. He's been reading the newspapers, going over things. And so he's taken a bunch of notes so that under pressure, the answers won't escape him. It's not like he got somebody gave him a sheet with all the questions in advance.
No, it's like he's written down in like different columns. Like answers that are, you know, that are sort of prompts to like, that story was about this, that story was about this, this country announced this, and then they'll be in different columns. So one will be the kind of newsier answers or the newsier events that happen. Then there'll be a whole column of kicker stories, weird. The one that's at the end where it's always like, a man in Australia was pulled over by police because he was driving while what? It's always that. And you never know the answer to that, usually, if you're a normal person. But the answer, by the way, is always kangaroo, if it's in Australia. So then another column of like the kicker story answers, and then another column, I don't know, miscellaneous. And yeah, these are news stories and answers that have been identified by the people in question. But they are still, you could sometimes be, you know, like they're asking you a question in the Lightning fill in the blank, and you can't remember if it's Turkey or North Korea that did the thing, and you look over and you have it in your notes right there. Like,
but that's so funny to me because by that point, you don't need those notes anymore. That really surprises me because when, you know, as a at-home listener, if I don't get the answers to a quiz, I probably just don't know it. If I knew it, it's in my brain. And Luke, you know, my brain is as bad as they come. It doesn't, with you know, it doesn't hold information very well. But this is all current event stuff. Like, if the answer is North Korea, you know it or you don't, especially if you've taken the time to write it down.
Mm-hmm. My brain is bad.
I can't point to any time that it has specifically, I've observed it specifically helping anyone win the game. Mm-hmm. But I will say that the people who do that are always the people who win the game. So, and well, you know what? Here's the thing. No one's stopping me from doing it if I cared enough. And you're right. I do care. Obviously, you can hear it in my voice. I think I'm more mystified by the whole thing because I'm surprised that at no time did anyone say like, oh, hey, you're bringing the answers on stage. But that's because, of course, it's not a real game. Nobody really cares who wins.
They just want it to be good radio.
Exactly.
Of course.
Exactly.
And so that's fine.
Whatever makes good radio. Yeah.
I do wish that they would take a more says you approach, which is also, or at least what says you used to do. I don't know if they still do this. But it was like, whose line is it anyway? Just make up ridiculous point schemes on the fly.
Right.
It's funnier that way.
Right.
And also nobody can get it in their head that they got screwed or whatever. Because
right.
It makes it absolutely over the top preposterous. That's what I like. Just be like, Luke, you got four of those right, but I like your panache. We're giving you 17 points.
Yes. The only issue with that would be, the ultimate scorekeeper at this point would be Bill Curtis, who is certifiably insane.
That's perfect.
I know. It would be amazing. Bill Curtis is a man who is a broadcasting legend. He is the owner of an organic grass-fed cattle farm in Kansas, where he hails from originally, Tallgrass. He is a person who is commonly sought out by hip-hop artists to record intros to their albums. He also did the intro to the Dandy Warhol's record that I love, Colder Than the Coldest something or other. This is a man who has so many awards and talents and has, oh, and not to mention those like American Greed shows you see, he produces all of those. Like, he has got it going on. And what he gets up out of bed on Thursday morning to do, and really I think the sort of point of his entire week, is to go to the Chase Bank Auditorium to read a Lumber Liquidators underwriting ad and to say, hardwood. And the whole crowd dies laughing because it sounds like he's talking about a boner. That is the highlight of Bill Curtis's week, is saying hardwood. Or he used to say, love. It's what makes a Subaru. And it's one bitchin' ride. Those were the two high points of his week, which is amazing considering all of his other accomplishments and awards.
So I assume that they then cut out the bitchin' rides.
They take the cut out bitchin' ride, and I think someone gave him a talking to about saying hardwood, about drawing hardwood out too long.
Yeah, because it's in the copy, right? It's just the implication.
It's always the implication. He also asked me the last time that I saw him how the baby was, and I said, "Are you talking about my wife?" And he said, "Yeah." Ooh. Not a joke. Bill Curtis, obsessed with my wife. And I think a joking way, ever since the three of us and some others went out to a place called the Tonga Room in San Francisco. Anyway.
Oh, when you always went hot tubbing together, right?
Yeah, of course.
That's my wife.
If you haven't hot tubbed with Bill Curtis, you have not lived. Anyway, Bill Curtis is genuinely one of the more quirky dudes I've ever met. And I say that as a high compliment. I mean, he is one of a kind. The idea of him making up the scores, it would actually be hilarious. It would be exactly what you're saying. Like, there would be no rhyme or reason to it at all, and it would probably be really entertaining.
Yeah, and of course, now this suggestion is probably possibly Lin Pham's head is exploding right now, because as the unofficial scorekeeper, that would probably, you know, it would make things much more difficult to keep in his precise notebooks if at the end of a certain episode, you know, Adam Felber has 1,700 points, Luke has 2, and Roxanne Roberts has fleeble-deeble points. You know what I mean? Like, I can see that being a problem.
I'm writing down fleeble-deeble points as a possible show title.
And you got to save all your fleeble-deeble points, and then you get one free fleeble-deeble at the end.
Are these enough fleeble-deeble points to get the remote control car? No, but you can get the Chinese finger torture at the lower part of the shelf. All right.
Anything below the thimble. And above the paper airplane.
Let's thank our dazzling donor today. And it is none other than Dr. Jim Hsu of Seattle, Washington. He does not list himself as Dr. Jim Hsu. He lists himself as Jim Hsu, but he is a doctor. And as a person who often impersonates a doctor, Andrew, I'll be damned if he's not going to get the credit he deserves for going to medical school.
Oh, so he's a real doctor.
And
just
let me also
kidding.
Apologize.
Just
let me apologize.
Kidding.
Let me use Dr. Jim Hsu's dazzling donor message to apologize to all of our PhDs who have made their voices known. Sorry, I said you're not real doctors. You're real doctors. You're the best. You can do surgery on me anytime. I'm sorry. I couldn't be more sorry. I apologize. It sounds like I'm being sarcastic, and I'm actually not trying to be sarcastic. I get why that would anger you. I get why that would crease you as a PhD. So sorry, I didn't mean to be dismissive.
It would be like if somebody said, "Well, you only have a daytime Emmy."
Yeah, exactly. And then sent me a rubber stamp that said Daytime Emmy Award winner Luke Burbank, which I treasure, which is right here on the shelf next to where I do the show. Thanks, LRB crew. It's honestly, I'll occasionally just go over and just like stamp that on Carrie's wrist. Just a reminder, who the Daytime Emmy Award winner in this household is.
It also helps that way she can get back in if she goes outside for a cigarette.
Yeah, exactly. We have a very, very strict policy. Okay, back to Dr. Jim Hsu, who dazzled us with his donation this year and has in the past and has been on the TBTL Tour de Terrible, where he, as a real medical doctor, humored the mummy as the mummy took us to opium, what he thought were opium poppies that he poked holes in and taught people how to drink the milk of a poppy so as to get some sort of high. And Dr. Jim Hsu, real live doctor, just said, oh, interesting. Okay, this is, I mean, just humored the heck out of a guy with no medical training whatsoever. Dr. Jim Hsu, the best, and he said, all right, since TBTL loves to wallow in meta situations, and I usually listen to TBTL while running, I thought, why not combine everything TBTL and see if I can achieve peak TBTL meta-ness as a tribute to the show that I've been following since 2008. Holy moly, Dr. Jim, that's a long time. So here's what he did. He said, I loaded up several of the latest TBTL episodes to do some catching up on my janky MP3 player. Dude, don't apologize for your MP3 player. I had one, and it's somewhere in this house. The problem with the iPod Nano, Andrew, is they've made it so small that you can now lose it very easily. I love loading up my iPod Nano and going for a jog. Anyway, Jim Hsu says, loaded up my janky MP3 player, planned out the most TBTL running route, and I mean that literally, and I set off this afternoon. Here were some of the TBTL highlights along the way of Dr. Jim's TBTL run. Mile 5.20 through mile 9 was Green Lake, where Luke spent much of his youth breakdancing. The once around... Do I have the dazzling donor music that has a break in the middle of it? Sure.
Yeah.
I do. Good. that's how I know it's mine.
That's one we've been using, you know.
So I don't mix it up with anyone else's dazzling donor music. Mine has an odd half-second break in the middle of it.
Think of it as a stamp.
Yeah,
an audio
thank
stamp.
You. It's a daytime dazzling donor theme. Luke spent much of his youth breakdancing at Green Lake. The once around the lake also naturally serves as the circle in the letter B of TBTL. Oh, I get it. So he also ran so that his jogging route spelled out TBTL.
Have you not seen this?
I heard that Amy Wu had the pictures, but I don't think I've seen the photos. You've seen the photos?
Oh, my God. I'm looking for it here. Let me see if I can
find
this.
Can this be our show picture?
Yes, it definitely will be this. It is amazing. What he did was he, spoiler alert, yes, ran a pattern so that when you look at the map, like from space, he wrote TBTL across the city of Seattle with his feet.
Unbelievable, Dr. Jim Hsu. Okay. He says mile 9.8 took him past Broadcast Coffee Roasters, current TBTL sponsor. Mile 13.3 was one block away from the Fraternal Order of Eagles, Airy Number 1. Andrew, possibly, I'm adding this part, possibly inside pulling tabs, mm-hmm. even as Dr. Jim went past.
The mother Airy.
Just under 2 hours and 15 miles later. What? I forget. Dr. Jim is a serious-ass runner. He says, I finally finished my run, a rather slow run, since I am not even supposed to be here running this far today, and Seattle is incredibly hilly in some parts. So I guess to really spell out TBTL and to hit these various TBTL high points, Dr. Jim had to run 15 miles to make this happen. He says, but if I was to run this, I wanted the finished product, the tracing on the map of TBTL, to look presentable. His Garmin says he burned 1,395 calories in literally running a TBTL. So then Dr. Jim says, I went by Dick's Drive-In on Holman Road, where Luke used to guesstimate total costs in his head and had a deluxe cheeseburger and a strawberry shake. That is exactly the way to celebrate running for 15 miles and 1,395 calories, Dr. Jim.
That's all in pride all, eating, as yes, Stephen Phyllis would say.
And you deserve it, my friend. All in all, a rather peak TBTL meta afternoon. Love the show. Have fun talking it up, guys, and thanks for letting us eavesdrop. Well, Dr. Jim, thanks. Thank you for making the show possible with your donation. Thanks for all you've contributed. You know, I believe it was Dr. Jim played the opening notes of the TBTL theme song for one of our live shows in Columbia City. His wife is a professional musician. He is an amazing musician who also dabbles in being an actual doctor. I mean, the stuff that this guy has contributed to the show over time is unbelievable. So thanks, Dr. Jim. We wouldn't be here talking it up and letting you all eavesdrop without you. So thanks, man. Appreciate it. Episode 2387 is because of you. I expect Dr. Jim's next run will spell out the numbers 2,387.
No, what he's going to do is next year he's got to figure out what day we'll thank him on. Predict it.
Good luck.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
All right. Our top story today comes to us by way of the Paris Review, NBD.
Did you lift your pinkies up off your teacup as you said that?
Always. I am thinking about getting a Paris Review tote bag just so people will think that I read the Paris Review. I mean, I dip in and dip out, and I wish that my brain were smart enough that I could be a person who like reads the Paris Review cover to cover. I have to say a lot of it is just beyond my abilities. But as you said, Andrew, when you sent me this article, you said this is pretty much the most Paris Review, most Paris Review-y thing that's ever been written. That being said, it brings up some really interesting ideas, I think. It was written by Zach Hatfield, and it is on the forgotten joys of the screensaver. He goes on to just talk about the sort of weird pleasure that a lot of us take in just staring, and this is of course back in the day, back in the 90s really, of just staring at these different kinds of screensavers that existed. Because of course there was a time when you were told that if you just left your computer on with like the let's say you were working on a document, if you just left your computer on and there was a document showing, that would burn like not holes, but that would basically like burn a permanent image into your computer screen. Or if you had your computer screen all black, that would be a problem. If you had anything going on too consistently on your computer screen, it was going to eventually kind of leave a ghosting effect. So people would have screensavers. I'm talking about this like it was the 1840s. People would have these screensavers that were supposed to just kind of randomly sort of enact all of the pixels on your computer screen in totally unpredictable intervals over time, right? Is that the basic idea of one of these kind of screensaver cool visual elements?
Yeah, and it happened around the same time people were pouring human waste out of their windows right into the streets.
On the Bowery.
The Bowery is around that time.
Yeah, exactly. The first actual screensaver software was published in a 1983 issue of Soft Talk, a now-defunct magazine devoted to the culture taking shape around home computers. Though the name implies its subscribers were interested in softcore phone sex, Soft Talk delivered coverage on programming, gaming, trade, and more in the early 80s. Readers of the issue in question would have turned to a page graced with a headline in a cataclysmic font, "Save your monitor screen," all caps, and an article with the same exclamatory tone. "At this very moment, your video monitor or IBM monochrome display may be in danger." It went on to sort of explain why it is that you need a screensaver pattern to save your monitor screen. He continues, "Along with hip-hop, sitcoms, and the economy, screensavers flourished during the Clinton years, reaching an apotheosis of creative expression. This Gilded Age was made possible by yet another misleading titled enterprise, After Dark, a software company headquartered in the Bay Area that effectively disrupted the screensaver market. Their mischievous additions to the genre included customizable classics like airborne toasters, a flying through space simulator, and a package of pop culture themed modules like Star Trek and The Simpsons.
Soft talk, After Dark. Why was everything sexual?
I don't know. But God, do I remember flying toasters.
Yeah.
And just thinking, like, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm not... this. Some of our listeners who are techno geeks with spreadsheet will know the real answer to this, and they may point out that what I'm saying is not even possible. But my memory is, when I was a kid... we had a series of, because we were the Burbanks, we had a series of like off-brand electronics in the house. I've talked about the fact that my dad was the only person who bought a video cassette player that is a VCP. You may have heard of VCRs, Andrew. The R was for record. The P in the Burbank house was for play, because our VCP would not record shit off the TV, which is the main fun of having a VCR. My sense is it was $20 more for the VCR, so we were the proud owners of a Lloyd's VCP.
But you could still, I mean, you could still rent Barton Fink and watch it. Mm-hmm. Your parents just wanted to make sure that you weren't, you know, breaking any FBI rules.
I'm so tempted to just drop the line right now, just at the mention of Barton Fink, a.k.a. Brain Donors, but I won't. We also had, instead of, I believe, the we had a computer called a Laser that was a knockoff of the Apple IIe. Mm. Apple IIe, very popular home computer. We had the Laser, which my dad built an elaborate wood locking cabinet, to keep the Apple IIe clone from being stolen by ne'er-do-wells. If they want this Apple IIe clone, they're going to have to take this wooden cabinet with it over my dead body. Anyway, so my memory is that we had something that wasn't video toaster on, and it may not have been on the IIe clone. It may have been on the next. We eventually updated the computer. I believe it was probably still some weird generic that my dad had sort of built from scratch. But I seem to remember that we had something that was like flying toasters, but it wasn't. It was almost like flying waffle irons or something. Like, the Burbanks couldn't afford flying toasters is my memory.
Right.
That may just be my own hard luck story that I've told myself. But I do remember seeing flying toasters and just thinking, this is flipping rad.
There was just like little cheap microwaves you could just heat up your bread in.
From the scratch and dent at best, formerly Jafco, which is where the Burbank microwave did come from. He also goes on to talk about, I never really had a PC, certainly in the house when I was a kid or when I got to college. So I'm a little bit less aware, Andrew, of this I guess it was a Windows product that would sort of go through like it was a brick maze.
Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up with that, or did you have that in your life at all?
Yeah, this is really where East meets West, I think, as far as our relationship is concerned, because the toaster one I knew of, but that was not something that is kind of baked into my brain. It's not burned onto my brain the way an Excel spreadsheet would be burned into a computer that didn't have a screensaver in 1994. The things that feel like home to me is this maze, which is this brick wall maze. Any, you know, PC owner from that era will remember this thing. It's a never-ending labyrinth where it's kind of... This came out around the time Doom came out, which I think is the first or one of the very early first-person shooter games. And so this kind of had that feel to it. You feel like you are the one walking in this endless maze of brick walls that, you know, has no end.
The sort of joy of looking at one of these things, there's also the, I don't know what you would call it. I don't know what the actual name is, but this kind of series of pipes that kind of build up and then reduce back down and build up and reduce back down is still mesmerizing to me to this day. There's a GIF of it in the Paris Review article, and I've been looking at it all morning, Andrew, because it is it's just weirdly relaxing. There's something about this stuff, and then this guy goes on to write about friends of his who would look at the, you know, would play iTunes at night and look at the way that that kind of random generating don't know what you'd call it, audio wave kind of representation of what was being played in iTunes, would stare at that all night.
The visualizer. I think that's what the official iTunes called. Name is, the visualizer, yeah.
There's even an art exhibition in Rotterdam called Sleep Mode that shows a bunch of these kind of iconic sleep. I keep wanting to call it. I mean, what do you actually call these things?
Screensavers.
They're called a screensaver because they're saving your screen. I know that seems obvious, but mm-hmm. I guess I get confused between. I don't know what the screen going
sleep,
black.
Like sleep mode.
Yeah,
sleep
something
mode
like that.
Is when your screen just goes black. And the writer kind of addresses that. And he says that in the day we had these things that were kind of an art form that were keeping mm-hmm. our computer screen safe. And now it's when the computers go to sleep, they go to sleep and they just look like dead computers, as opposed to, he kind of paints this picture of like being in a office, you know, at lunchtime, when everybody's left their little cubicles and you would just walk through and just see everybody's screensaver, in many cases, the laser beams just kind of folding into themselves, a very, very classic Microsoft screensaver. But then you could also, you know, put your pictures of your family and vacation in there, and then they'll dissolve and then another one will come up. And he really does paint this good word picture of walking through a hall of an empty office building, seeing all of these screensavers and just saying that they're so much more impactful than just a bunch of dead screens.
Right. I mean, you have sleep mode and then you have flip mode, which is when Busta Rhymes actually comes in from the IT department and like fixes something on your computer. But he acts really annoyed to do it. He's just like, whoa, ha, the whole time. And you're just like, I get it. I did it wrong. I didn't know I was supposed to download that. I'm sorry. By the way, Busta Rhymes as IT guy is a short film I would watch.
Whoa, ha! Did you try restarting it? That was bad.
That was bad. That was good. That joke had so many levels to it. Well, two, but that's a lot for us. It had a thing that IT always seems to say as if he tried restarting it. I thought that was a very good spoof, my friend.
Thank you.
So here's the thing. I guess I don't have a huge experience with screensavers, but I do have a screensaver that comes to mind. It's not computer related, but it was when we lived in Port Townsend and we had our in our TV room, we had a DVD player plugged in because it was, you know, this was the 1970s, so we were still using DVDs, and we had a DVD player. That was like Carrie's before we got together, plugged into our TV. And for whatever reason, when the TV would go to sleep, it would start to show the logo, like a flat screen TV that's a rectangle. And then the logo of the DVD player company was a rectangle, and it would bounce around mm-hmm. the screen.
Yep.
And about once every 2.5 hours, it would bounce into the corner and it would perfectly fit into the corner.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Every other time it would just miss it by a micrometer.
So close.
And I would sit there and stare at it, waiting for it to fully engage with the corner. Sometimes to the point where I'd be like, I can't go to bed until it does the full corner.
You are torturing me just by describing this.
You smell me, dog?
I smell you, dog. I smell your sour dogs. Just like picturing this is, but you don't smoke pot. I mean,
that's the
really,
thing. I mean, I probably had some alcohol in me, but no, sure. this was not based on any drugs other than booze juice.
See, that's the opposite of what I think this writer is trying to get across. Like the kind of, the solitude and peacefulness. I don't know if you mentioned this. His name is Zach Hatfield. I'm sure you did. The peace and solitude of these screensavers, what you're describing is kind of the opposite. It's like, it is a screensaver, but that one sounds like torture.
Well, I found it to be, it was torture up until it wasn't. Like, it would be like, oh, okay, this is going to be it. It just kind of ponged off the bottom corner and then the side, and now it's going back, and I'm like, this is going to be the one, and then it would just miss, bong, it would pong off to the other thing, but when it eventually did, just, and it was just for a second. It almost felt like it was going to like unlock the screen and you were going to be able to fight Mike Tyson or something. Felt like you were hype. You were hyper driving to somewhere else if it actually happened. But the other thing too is that, you know, as happens when you're in a relationship, you have all kinds of different conversations with your partner. Some of them serious, some of them light. And I have also these memories of having these really intense, long conversations about various topics, including our relationship, and the whole time watching that square bounce around.
Yeah.
Like, that, I know. You know, yeah. That kind of a thing?
Yep, I know that kind of thing.
My parents have one of these clocks that's like burled wood. It was very big with Christian people from Northern California in the 70s, and I believe remains so. But it would be like a piece of wood, like a piece of wood that had been, I don't know what actually burls it, if it's that it's like growing underground and it's like the root system or whatever. But, you know, there was a big thing, like just put burled wood clock into the.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking
into the internet.
Now.
And someone.
Yeah, this is what I was picturing. It's almost like, and maybe this is not the right description, but I'd never heard the term burled wood before. But when you were just describing it right now, I was picturing this, which is, it's like a cross section of a tree or a stump, yeah, if you will, like the trunk of a tree, and maybe it's several inches thick, but it's the entire cross section of it, and that's like your flat clock face, and then it's heavily, heavily lacquered, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we had, now I'm trying to figure out, what the process on burl. A burl is a tree growth in which the grain has grown in a deformed manner. It's usually found on the trunk at the base of the tree and sometimes underground in the form of a rounded outgrowth. It's caused by some kind of stress, such as injury, virus, fungus, insect infestation, or mold growth. So there you go. And then you cut that thing in half, and then you cover it in like 85 coats of lacquer, and then you sell it to Walter Burbank, and then it's hanging on a wall for Luke's entire childhood. So we had one of those clocks. I mean, it was in the house that we lived in. The majority of my childhood was spent at 77th and Aurora in the Green Lake neighborhood of Seattle. I don't know if Dr. Jim made it past there in his journeys of spelling out TBTL. But anyway, in that house, we had this clock forever. And so many intense conversations were had looking at this clock. Me walking into the house to tell my, and then sitting and watching the news, waiting to tell my dad that I got someone pregnant. I'm looking at that burled clock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like finding out that this kid that I knew had a brain tumor and ended up passing away, a kid from my church. I'm looking at that burl clock. You know how there are those weird things that they're just sort of like visual. I don't know. Visual history is really the right way to describe it, but they're just like your companion unintentionally through so many events in your life that when you see one, like when I see a burl clock, I'm immediately like a kid again, thinking about intense things that happened in my life where that clock was in the backdrop.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. I can't think of a specific example that's kind of along those lines, but I have talked on the show about my kind of recent obsession with kind of possessions from my childhood and going to these giant flea markets in L.A. and just running across this toy train, this battery-operated toy train that I had. And I would have never in a million years remembered that this toy train even existed. But then the second I saw it and I picked it up, I could practically smell my youth. I think it's kind of similar to that. A little bit different, a less permanent version of this is I remember being a little kid and having a very kind of tough conversation with my parents where they had to explain something to me. I'm trying to respect some folks' privacy here, so sure. I'm not going to go into detail, but somebody in my family was sick and had to go to the hospital, and that prevented me from continuing, I think, T-ball. Or maybe I guess it was just straight up Little League there. I guess the point of this story is not whether or not people are pitching or hitting balls off of tees. Anyway, my parents are both sitting me down, and It didn't seem like it had to be that heavy of a conversation, but clearly it was heavy to my parents. And as a kid, I was vibing off of that. So I remember sitting at the kitchen table and they're just having this very serious conversation with me and making sure that I'm okay with everything and letting me know that it's not my fault that I can't continue baseball. I don't think I really cared that much. I probably just did it because they told me to.
Maybe it got you out of a couple of jams, this whole personal situation.
The whole time I still had my napkin from dinner and the plates were clear, but I still had my napkin from dinner and I just kept on pulling off these tiny little pieces of the napkin and bawling them down and putting them down in front of me. I was just, the whole time they were talking, I'm just nervously doing this. And then at the end of the conversation, I think one of my parents just looked down and been like, okay, great. So you're taking this well. And you just saw this like intricate design that I had made with like hundreds of tiny little beaded pieces of paper.
You had built a burled clock out of napkin parts.
Right. So that is not a physical thing. Do you mind if I go back? Because I think that
Please. We
need to kind of probably wrap up this segment of the show. But I just want to read this paragraph again from this Paris Review article by Zach Hatfield that kind of does a better job of describing the solidarity that I, or not solidarity, I'm sorry, the solitude of the screensaver. And I just do think, as much as I'm kind of laughing at the writing style of this Paris Review, I think it's also very knowing as well. And he's kind of playing it up and he writes, "You can't consume a screensaver in an instant. You can't fast forward or rewind one. The genre, its own kind of endurance art, shuns immediacy. Fugitives from time, screensavers possess no real beginning or end. Their ouroboric nature." What does ouroboric mean?
How do you spell it?
O-U-R-O-B-O-R-I-C. Ouroboric nature.
I will tell you that there are, it's relating to the, this will help Andrew, relating to the ouroboros.
That's what I figured.
A snake eating its own tail.
Oh, okay. Okay, good.
Wow, there. Don't we just say, I guess they just say snake eating its own tail. This is
Which,
what the Paris, this is what the Paris Review does. They know words for things that I don't know.
I do think this is, so I'll continue. "Their ouroboric nature is perhaps why preservations on YouTube, whether 10 minutes or 12 hours long, tend to evoke disenchantment. Decades ago, stumbling upon a screensaver in a shared living room, or perhaps finding an entire office full of them at lunchtime, cubicles lambent with workers' judiciously chosen modules, likely signaled your own solitude. When you're watching one intentionally, that feeling never arrives." So again, him kind of saying it was like stumbling upon these things meant that you were probably alone in some way with the remnants of somebody who used to be there.
Wow. That's beautiful. See, that's why you put up with all of the hard words in a Paris Review article, because that's a really interesting concept, right?
Just sound it out. Sound it out.
Just study it out. That's all you got to do. Study it out.
All right. I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now. But have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I got to say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
Here I go once again with the email. Every week I hope that it's from a female. Oh man, it's not from a female.
All right, we have some emails here, and I want to read them.
that sounds like a
plan. I'm just starting to. I'm just kind of I wanted, the reason I was making that weird sound was because I kind of wanted to jump ahead to the King of Thailand because I was so dazzled by these deets. Is that okay, Andrew?
It doesn't matter to me. Yeah, we have a lot of emails, so I think we're going to be reading these over the next few days.
Okay, cool. So a few days ago, back when we were in Minnesota, we came up with a, I think, snappily named, what do we call it? Royal Pains? No, what was the
name? Oh, I think.
Did we ever get there?
Yeah, the Royal Crown. There's something about Royal Crown.
The Dingus Crown Affair.
The Dingus
but
Crown
then
Affair,
somebody
yeah.
was getting at us on Twitter with some good ideas, too. But anyway, we talked about royalty in the news, and one of the stories was about the King of Thailand, who seems like he's kind of a person who wasn't really that interested in being the king. He was really interested in being rich and being maybe the prince of Thailand. But his father, who was apparently beloved there, passed away, and now this guy's the king. And he was walking around in a mall in Germany with just like wicked amounts of tattoos on, and he's wearing a yellow crop top. And when that video popped up on Facebook, the nation of Thailand was trying to suppress it. And so a listener, Kirsten, said, after listening to Thursday's show, I've got to share some dazzling deets about everyone's favorite crop top wearing, belly bearing monarch. A dazzling deet number one. Many news outlets reported in their coverage of the Facebook kerfuffle that the Body Ink, the King of Thailand Sports, are actually fake tattoos. Mm. I've seen a few articles, including The Independent, mentioned the tattoos were indeed fakes, in particular with the arm sleeves. And if you take a gander at the many crop top ensemble photos, you'll see that the arm sleeves definitely change in length and design, as do the tummy tats. This raises so many questions for me, Andrew. So this guy, I guess if this is true, this guy wants to be seen as this like tatted up cool dude, but he doesn't want to really get the tattoos. So he puts the fake tattoo on, but then you're not going to see that he's a tatted up cool guy. So he has to wear the crop top to show off the tattoos. Could that be what's behind the crop top wearing?
I think it's part of it. I mean, he's clearly got an individual style, right? I mean, these crop tops, like, not to stereotype, but our listener here, I'm blanking on her name, Aaron.
Kirsten.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Kirsten. Sent along some photos, too, and I didn't have a good way of getting them to you, Luke. I don't know if you've seen it, but, like, this crop top look is a common thing with him, and he looks, not to stereotype, but, like, he looks like he would be in, like, a gay club, right? Like, it's a very flamboyant look he's going for.
Right. I don't think, and the articles I read, I don't think there's any, I don't think that the what anyone, I know what you're saying. Yes, he looks like he could be hanging out in South Beach in a, you know, at a gay bar. I don't think that the indication is that he might be a gay man who is not comfortable talking about it, or that he has lived a secret gay life, which is why I was a little confused by all of this, because his outfit doesn't scan with what the rest of his sexual orientation appears to be, based on the fact that he has a bunch of kids and that he's been married to women, and that, you know.
Yeah.
Caveat being that lots of people do that and are gay, but whatever. Point being, I couldn't figure out what was going on with this look, and what I think it is, now that I know the tats are fake, is that I think this is the outfit that he wears when he wants to show off the tats. Are there any pictures of him in the crop top without the tats?
Not that I saw. So, yeah, I mean, the reason I bring that up is, I guess maybe when you say cool, tatted up guy, that sort of evokes another kind of stereotype, right? Like a big, like, kind of butchy, masculine guy, you know, with, you know, more of like a motorcycle kind of thing. But instead, like his, and I'm not trying to imply that he's secretly gay or anything like that. I'm just saying that his aesthetic just is more South Beach.
But I'm saying, I think that what drives it is that he wants people to see these tattoos. Like, what's the use of having a fake tattoo put on if then you just wear like a collared shirt over it and no one can see it? So he's on the horns of a dilemma. He's got these fake tats on, which he wants to be walking around like, get a load of me. But you have to wear a shirt when you're at a mall in Germany, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, what's the least shirt I can wear that will show off the tats the most, but I can be in public where people can see the tats and be like, whoa, that guy's hardcore. That guy is cool. So he ends up – to me, it's like, I think that must be what's driving the crop top behavior, is just a desire to show off the tats, but the need for there to be something that is nominally a shirt.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you're right. That seems to all add up.
That sounds like a logical read on the situation. Dazzling deet number two, Prince – Maha is also famous for the devotion he showed to his pet poodle, Fufu. A little on the nose for the poodle name, mm-hmm. wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
His pet poodle, Fufu, which he awarded the rank of Air Chief Marshal in the Royal Thai Air Force. That's got to really hurt if you spent your whole life becoming an Air Chief Marshal in the Royal Thai Air Force.
Right.
And now Fufu has got the same, you know, he's wearing the same, you know, buttons and scrambled eggs as you.
Well, what if you're actually lower than Marshal? Then you have to salute this dog. Think about that.
That's worse.
Yeah.
Fufu frequently appeared at the official functions, including accompanying the then Crown Prince to a 2007 reception hosted in his honor by the U.S. Ambassador Ralph Boyce. Mr. Boyce allegedly recounted the event in a leaked cable, writing, "Fufu was present at the event, dressed in formal evening attire, complete with paw mitts. And at one point during the band's second number, he jumped up on to the head of the table and began lapping from the guests' water glasses, including my own. The Air Chief Marshal's antics drew the full attention of the 600-plus audience members and remains the talk of the town to this day," end quote.
I like I like that the ambassador calls or refers to the dog with its proper title, Chief Marshal.
I know. I have to say, considering that was like a leaked cable, you know, that was not probably meant for public consumption. It's pretty respectful, rather.
I agree.
Because
that's why this person
is. If you're having a real conversation
ambassador.
Where that happened, you'd be like, "Da fuck."
Right. No. That's why ambassadors
have
skills.
This guy's
got
a fucking dog wearing mitts, and the dog is like eating people's food during the official thing. Can you believe?
Right.
Like, that would be the tone normally. But this particular ambassador, Ralph Boyce, he clearly knows that these cables can be intercepted, so he was using discreet language to describe things.
Like if it was Lucy from the Peanuts, her leaked cable would have just said, "Yuck!"
Exactly.
She doesn't like dog kisses.
Kirsten says, "In my humble opinion, Pod Dog definitely deserves the rank of Air Chief Marshal too, and the TBTL Hive Mind should brainstorm on the Pod Kitty's appropriate rank. Professor Bananas, being already of the academic caste, can be excused of military duty." I like the idea that Professor Bananas gets a, what do you call that, a waiver?
Yeah,
what do they call it when you don't have to, when you're not in the draft, have to do military service because of, you know, being a professor. But the problem is the Bay Kitty and Theo Murray are going to have to go fight on the front lines because they're not escaping to Canada. Although it's possible that some days Olive does go to Canada and comes back. We just
probably.
Don't know.
Oh, shoot. Not the time or the place, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm not going to give you all the background on this. There's no time for that. But just settle a bet between Genevieve and I.
Okay.
Do you guys up there in Bellingham, almost on the Canadian border, do you see a lot of Canadian currency? If somebody were to pay for a loaf of bread in Bellingham with a Canadian bill, that would not be normal.
Well, I don't work in retail, and so I bet you if you went to the Trader Joe's down the hill from us, where there are tons of Canadians that shop there, I bet you that they could give you a more accurate answer on how much Canadian paper money is used. I've certainly seen Canadian paper money in my life many times.
Okay. I really do not have time to get into the background of the story, but somebody tried to give me $10 Canadian this weekend, and I was like, no, thank you. I'll take $10 American, please. This is America. And then Genevieve and I were talking about it later, and I said, well, I'm sure up in Bellingham, like maybe this guy is just from way north, and, you know, maybe in places like Bellingham, it's kind of interchangeable more. But apparently not.
But, you know, here's the thing. If somebody wants to pay you and your choice is Canadian money or no money, take the Canadian money because do is go into any bank.
Right.
Give it to them when you're at the bank and they'll give you the equivalent, whatever the exchange rate is. Like, it's not as hard. You don't have to fill out any paperwork, you know, or do anything like that. Like, when we came back on the inauguration day when Carrie and I went north of the border, I came back unintentionally with a bunch of Canadian money, just went to the bank. Swapped it out. I'll tell you this about Canadians, Andrew. I was thinking about this the other day because I had a Canadian that was just riding my butt, just hot running in right behind me in the car. Canadians drive, at least in this area, Canadians drive way faster than Americans. And I don't know what's up with that because Canadians are thought of, I think, as a sort of a peace-loving people. You know, they're they seem like a lot of times they reflect the better nature of what it's like to live in North America. And Americans are kind of like, we're the rootin' is tootin'est country on this continent.
Yeehaw.
But the Canadians seem to have it kind of have it together. But I'll tell you what, man, they are speeding their asses off in the state of Washington. And I know this because they have, Canadian plates. So this is, it's immediately apparent where the person hails from. And they just drive super fast. I don't know if it's at the – and so I was trying to reverse engineer a theory. Like, is it lax speeding enforcement in Canada? So
– higher limits.
So they're just like – is it higher limits? Is it lax enforcement? Or is it that they think that they don't have to worry about paying a speeding ticket if they get it in the U.S.?
Because
it won't follow them? I mean, the reason I don't drive 90 everywhere is because I don't want to get another speeding ticket. It's not because I think there's anything wrong with driving 90. But I'm wondering what the Canadian – oh, and speaking of Canadians, Andrew, did you know that you are the proud owner of a fidget spinner? You just don't know it yet?
I am personally.
A listener, Bill in Toronto, mailed us two fidget spinners.
Oh, nice. I honestly – when you said that, I was like looking around my office being like, do I have something that's technically a fidget spinner and I didn't know it all along? That's awesome. Okay,
that
great.
WMMS morning show record can be a fidget spinner if your hands are big enough.
You just put your finger in the middle of it and you spin it around. Well, that's great. Well, thanks, Bill. I appreciate that. We'll get that P.O. box set up soon.
Well, we'll take those. We could take those on the road with us. There's a yellow one and a black one. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize they were different colors. I just took one out of the box at random, and it was a black one.
Oh, good.
But you can choose if you want the yellow one or the black one.
I think I want the yellow one.
The yellow one's pretty cool looking, I got to be honest.
Yeah.
And then last night I came in after I opened these up, because I'd been gone for a while, so I was just going through the mail, opened the fidget spinner up, sat down on the couch next to Carrie, who was kind of half asleep, half awake, watching TV. I started spinning it.
Mm-hmm.
She just looked over me. She went, nope. Took it away from me, put it under the blanket, went back to sleep. Confiscated my fidget spinner.
Did she put it in the drawer where she puts all of your confiscated toys?
She's got my nunchucks in there, man. She's got my throwing stars. This is bullshit, man. I can't do anything fun here, man.
It's my wife.
All right. We should get out of here, Andrew, but we should pick a title for the show. I wrote down one thing, which was Fleeble Deeble Point.
That's okay. I wrote down Soft Talk After Dark.
Oh, I like that.
Sounds
erotic.
And then I had one idea for a song, but we don't have to go with this, but it's a way of me squeezing in a little bit of sharpshooting as well. A couple of people wrote in, to talk about the song Stewbot played at the end of Friday's show. If you'll recall, the song we played was Jackie Blue. I absolutely fell in love with it. It was awesome. I think that he said that it was by whom? He said it was by Black Oak, Arkansas, but it was actually by the Ozark Mountain Daredevils. So we could make up for that by playing a different song by Black Oak, Arkansas.
We should do that. So we're going to play, because they were misidentified the first time, we're going to play another Black Oak, Arkansas.
Yeah, so we get, and their most famous song is Jim Dandy, which I know from the Dazed and Confused soundtrack. Do you know that song? It's the only song I know.
But
their most popular one on Spotify is called Hot and Nasty. So I'd rather
Do you want to hear my McConaughey?
Yeah.
I do a pretty decent McConaughey from that movie. Time is a flat circle.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's from the Lincoln Lawyer, actually. I'm sorry. That's from the Lincoln Lawyer.
Ed TV. That whole thing was a buildup just so you could pull Ed TV. I love it.
It wasn't, but I'm glad we got there.
All right. So we'll call it Soft Talk After Dark. Here's a little Jim Dandy by Indeed, Black Oak, Arkansas.
Sweet. Thanks for listening, everybody. And really, Andrew, really good job the last couple of days.
Oh,
man.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for handling biz. We will see all of you tomorrow with more Imaginary Radio for you. Until then, please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
out